Hello, I'm Angela Belt, and welcome back to the Mood Board Podcast. For those of you who are in the U.S., happy Women's History Month. I'm just really excited as a Black woman. It's been like back-to-back fun for us. We have Black History Month and Women's History Month, and I've just been having some incredible conversations, and I'm so excited now that you guys get to hear all of them. Today, I'm really excited to have Nasozi Kakembo on the show. I have known Nasozi for a long time now. I remember when she first started working at Apartment Therapy, and then I remember her talking about this business, which is now called XN Studio, and she'll talk about her journey in the interview. But it's been really interesting watching her business evolve. I think what's always been interesting to me is that Nasozi has always made sure that her business was more than just selling beautiful African textiles. There's always also been a focus on social justice. And I think now more than ever, when we are looking at what's happening in Ukraine and the inhumanity of what's happening there, it's so important to focus on businesses that go beyond just selling you products. Kind of what is the next layer of what keeps them going? Lastly, what I want to touch on is that Nasozi and I really talk about what is it like to be a Black-owned business, women-led, where we know those two things together already are going to be a tough road for you. You know, what is her why? What keeps her going with the business? And I'm also hoping that you guys will think about it as well. I've actually posed that question this week in the interview for you listeners to ask yourself, what is your why that keeps you going on your dream, your business, that just keeps propelling you forward? I'd love if you'd share those, and maybe we can talk about them in some upcoming episodes.
Many people have been asking me, how can they support my business? And let me tell you, if you're listening to this podcast, you are already on the right path. So just make sure that you subscribe and share it with your friends and family. But a second thing you can do is sign up for my Skillshare class, The Art of Styling Your Room, How to Create a Mood Board. In less than 15 minutes, you will have all the tools you need to begin to design your dream space. I will also provide feedback on Skillshare and share students' work on my Instagram feed. So on that note, let's get started with the show.
Good morning, Nasozi. I'm so excited to have you on the Mood Board Podcast. I think as we just talked about, it's been a long time since we've really gotten to talk. We've definitely been social media friends for a long time, but I am just excited to connect and talk about your business. I've been a fan for a long time. I remember when you were working with Apartment Therapy and doing all these other different hats. And really, it's been great just to watch your business continue to grow. I feel like I'm always trying to pin pieces from it. I was excited when I got one of your baskets and I kind of built my whole bathroom around that idea. My husband's like, really? Just the basket? I'm like, this is the bathroom.
You're in this basket.
Yes. So I'm so happy you were able to come on today.
Yeah. Well, it's so good to virtually see you again and to hear your voice and to be sitting down with you in a sense after so many years. But, you know, similar to what you've alluded to, social media has kept us really close despite some of the distances and the changes over the years. But thank you for being such a long time, you know, supporter and promoter of my work. It goes a very long way. And I've always, you know, reciprocated that admiration and respect for your craft as well. So I think it's definitely, you know, a symbiosis. And I'm just happy to chat with you today, to catch up with you today. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So for first time listeners, one, just share with them how long you've been in business and how would you describe it?
Sure. So I founded XN Studio in 2011, which at the time had a different name. I think when I started, it was Origin Style by Nasozi, and I spelled it in a funky way because I founded the business in Bed-Stuy where I was living at the time. So I spelled style with the U, like it was a whole thing. It just felt right. So I was just going off of the vibes in the early days, like just, you know, fabric and vibes. And I hadn't anticipated you know, scaling in any sense or making this my full-time job. I really was just honestly using it as a creative outlet. My son was 2 years old at the time. He's 13 now. And I was working a full-time job in international development and human rights philanthropy in Manhattan. So that was pretty much my life. It was like son and Manhattan, son and Manhattan. And every now and again, you know, catching an art exhibit or a craft fair or all of the many, you know, entertainment and cultural events that are in Brooklyn and easily accessible when living in that space. So I was always surrounded by arts and culture, not even to mention my upbringing, which is my mother managed an art gallery, an African art gallery in Washington, D.C., in the Georgetown, Upper Georgetown neighborhood. So I basically was raised in an art gallery. I have many memories of like being the daughter in the corner and their different, you know, receptions or whatever going on. But, you know, they had to bring me because
they did. They were like, look, but we got to sell some art. I love that.
We got to make this work. So it all just kind of came together in the business, which I started out essentially with an Etsy shop because I just kind of figured I needed an internet presence, a digital presence. In 2011, of course, you know, Facebook was the main social media channel. I don't think there was Instagram yet, at least not in any meaningful or obligatory kind of way as it is today. So it was, in a sense, a much more in-person and direct experience in those early days. I spent a lot of time and hours of my life in different street markets and festivals and connecting with a lot of my customers and interested people in person then. And even to this day, most of them still follow me on social media, or they're still placing orders, or will recognize each other, you know, when I'm in Brooklyn or in different parts of the city. So, you know, those early days really cemented something special. And I think remembering those, albeit very unstructured as they were, it was really the essence of, you know, it was a true passion. It was an absolute true passion. So that was 11 years ago, almost, or a little bit over 10 years ago. I'm now in my 11th year of running the business.
So crazy that's been that long, but it's wonderful too to have a Black business, 11 years, woman led. Like, that's awesome to be still going.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk about this. I know you were saying that you had put this quote up on Instagram. I saw this recently and I wanted to talk about it. And you said, really, in the beginning, it was so hard to sell African decor to retailers, which I think many people now, if we think about it, it's everywhere. It's an explosion. Right. You can get it home goods, highest end stores. It's just everywhere. But back then, why did you feel like you were getting the pushback?
Yeah, I'm happy that you're asking me that question. And I'm going to just be really frank. I feel like it was discrimination. You know, in the most extreme sense, perhaps, and in the very least, it was just a short-sightedness. But I mean, I remember very distinctly certain instances in which, you know, I would, in different parts of the country, because whether I was visiting friends that I have on the West Coast or in Boston or in wherever around the US, I usually would always have samples with me and look up the stores in the area prior to going and make like a little, you know, a short list of stores that I wanted to introduce my work to. And I just remember very clearly being in Oakland. One of my brothers lives in Oakland, and we all know Oakland, you know, it's a very progressive, beautiful, and, you know, culturally aware city. And a lot of my online customers were also and still are from the Oakland area, the Bay Area, all basically the entire West Coast has always really supported my brand and my company. So I learn a lot from those metrics and analytics in terms of where, you know, where are people really feeling my work. And Oakland has always been, you know, toward the top of that list. And so, you know, I was there visiting my brother. I might have also been there for a market as well, but I took samples to a store in, you know, in one of the shopping areas in Oakland. and prepared like this really lovely package for the owner. And I think I had contacted her to tell her I was coming ahead of time and put a card, et cetera, dropped off the sample. And they were already similar, you know, similar home goods and goods for sale in the store. Like, as far as I was concerned, like, it made perfect
sense.
It was
a perfect
fit. I'm also curating. I don't just want my work in any place. I understand. And I also have standards for where I want my work to appear and what I want my name to be and my brand to be associated with. So it goes both ways. And, you know, so I had also very intentionally decided, so let's see, let's try this out. And I felt pretty good about it. Fast forward a couple of days later, and I had left Oakland by that time, but one of my good friends went to pick up the package for me after the owner had finished reviewing the samples, and she hadn't even opened the card.
Oh, wow. So she's like, that's like, just a no.
Did she even like look at this? You know, and the card was just like, it was for her, personalize it, had a nice note, contact information. She didn't even open it. And then years later, maybe even months later, like, she was carrying work similar to mine. And so if not even, I think I left her maybe a mud cloth sample or something like that. But I did find, and I continue to find, that when, whether it's a small retailer or a large retailer, when they do come around to understand and appreciate the value of African-made, Afrocentric, African-inspired home decor in that end of, you know, the design industry, they don't even go back to the Black or African makers and businesses to source it. So it's just like insult to injury, you know, like, when, granted, like, I had very firmly planted that seed and she didn't come back to me.
Yeah, we
didn't come back to me.
So. I just did another interview with another Black-owned business, and they're also from Africa, from East Africa. Mm-hmm. And she was sharing similar stories about where, you know, when she was presenting to stores, people were always asking her, like, is it authentic? And she was like, well, I'm from there. My family's still from there. And she was like, I felt like I got so much pushback. She goes, and then I wasn't picked up. She's like, but later I would come back to the store, and that those pieces that I had shown were similar were in the store.
Exactly.
Like, they just didn't want it from me, you know? And I was
didn't want it from me. Absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, that in and of itself, I think, says a lot about that establishment and that person. I would rather not work with that person. At that point. But when it comes down to business, that is very directly removing our and preventing our opportunities to succeed as Black business people, very directly. And that's unacceptable. And I don't know if it's just like a lapse in business. It's bad business for them. But I guess the powers of, you know, wanting to gatekeep the access to success and achievement is really overrides a desire for representation.
Yeah.
And it's really, you know, it for me, that is probably the biggest challenge that I experience as a business owner. It has nothing to do with the supply chain. It has nothing to do with the artisans who speak a completely different language with me. It is the, you know, the other end of the business piece, and really getting retailers to be honest about their sourcing practices in that sense, and making it an intentional piece to source from people who look like the work that they're selling.
Like, we're not trying to give you a presentation for inspiration. It's
absolutely not.
It's to do business.
It's to do business.
So on that note, I think, you know, we're kind of leading that way anyway. Why is social justice such an important part of your business?
Yeah. So for me, social justice is part of everything almost. I feel like, you know, it's inherent and intrinsic to so much, you know, so much that we already do. And the business for me, I mean, part of what we just talked about wasn't even part of my social justice formula or like theory of change going into the social impact component. I still don't know actually how to appropriately tackle that, because I'm really more concerned I'm really more concerned at this stage with how social justice impacts the lives of the artisans that I'm working with. So maybe not concerned, not to say that I'm more concerned with it, but that has been the strategic
That's your focus.
Angle.
Okay.
That's been the focus. And so, you know, my background, my educational background is in international development and urban planning, which ties heavily into access to, you know, whether it's basic infrastructural services, access to education, access to political participation. There's a whole spectrum. So that compounded with the fact that I have family in, you know, spaces both in the US and also significantly too in Uganda, where you know, those pictures look very different. They look very different than you know, than they do here. So it's always been kind of top of mind from the time that, you know, I started visiting Uganda and spending more time there in my teens, and wondering why, you know, based on my experience in growing up in the US, how come my very own cousins who are the same age as me or younger children, et cetera, how come their access to different basic rights looks different than my access? And there are also, you know, on the flip side, there are also certain virtues and certain opportunities that we don't have here living in America that they have there. So I don't want it to seem in any way like, you know, I'm pitying.
Yeah, woe is my fan. Yes. Right.
Yeah, like that's not the situation at all. But in some senses, there are just, you know, very basic challenges that people in quote unquote developing countries face that I wanted to do something about. And there was no way that I could kind of indulge in decoration and interiors or anything for that matter and not have it also become a mechanism for affecting social change. So it took me a while to figure out exactly what I wanted that to look like. I worked for close to 10 years in, like I mentioned, in social justice and human rights philanthropy. So I had seen different ways that it both worked and didn't work at a very high level. And basically what I took away is that you can make a big difference with not that much money. And there can just be, you know, on smaller scales and in smaller organizations, you can have a bigger impact because you can just be more direct. There's less bureaucracy, there's less red tape. And then you have the opportunity to establish more meaningful relationships and connections. And so also in many, you know, cultures and in many families where you have, where you're either a first generation immigrant or, you know, the daughter or child of an immigrant, you're sending money back home for, you know, for one reason or another, whether it's for school fees or if a relative is building a house or somebody's having a wedding celebration. So we were always sending money back home. And to this day, so the, like, it was already, you know, part of what we did. You just do it.
It's your family.
It's just your family. And so remittances are huge, and there's, you know, a whole remittance economy, et cetera. So I decided if I were to formalize that through my business and to you know, set up a pipeline, then I could actually do more work related to working with institutions and schools and other areas that I care about. In Uganda, and then eventually scaling to other countries as well. So that is the inception and the story behind the Mukono Foundation, which I also know you were curious
That's our
about.
Next question. So perfect.
We got a nice flow going on here.
Right, we're just, it's flowing very nicely.
Exactly.
So I think let's talk about the Mukono Foundation. You know, what is it, again, for listeners, and how does your business partner with it? And also, how can listeners also participate and be a part of it as well?
Sure. Yeah. So the Mukono Foundation is essentially the philanthropic arm of XN Studio. And the XM Studio, which is the product and service design company, which you all have seen on Instagram and in the press, et cetera. We've always donated a percentage of any of our fair trade goods back to Uganda or the respective country where the goods are made. So some of our goods are fair trade, they're made in Uganda or they're made in Tanzania or Ghana, and other goods are made here in the US. So it's about 2/3 are fair trade Africa, and then 1/3 are made in the US, usually by me, by my hands.
Okay. Oh, very cool. I didn't know this.
So yeah, thank you. And so like off the top, a percentage is saved and it goes back to primary education. And so what the foundation does, the foundation acts as that nonprofit conduit to be able to then distribute those funds. So XM Studio donates that 10% to the foundation, and the foundation administers those funds accordingly. And the foundation also conducts fundraising efforts, et cetera, and different campaigns toward that end. So ways in which people can participate, you can buy any of our fair trade goods on XM Studio. And then the Mukono Foundation at mukono.org, M-U-K-O-N-O.org, also receives monetary donations directly on the website, and they're all tax deductible. It is a 501c3, so everything is set up for those purposes as well. And I'll also state quickly, Mukono is the name of the district where my father is from. And I also work with our basket artisans are in Mukono district as well. So that's where the name comes from, Mukono.
And I will be sure to have links for all of that on my website as well, just so it's really easy when you listen to this conversation to participate.
Great. Thank you, Angela.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we jump to the interior design game, I just want to talk about, because you've been doing this now for over 10 years. You know, what keeps you going? What is your favorite part of doing this business?
Yeah. So what keeps me going? You know, I'm a glutton for good design. It just does something for my...
I need it.
I just need it. My eyes need just visual harmony. And that can mean different things for different people. But, you know, my home is an endless laboratory. I'm constantly switching it around and trying out new products or new displays or new layouts. And here, before you see them on the website or before you see them on my Instagram, sometimes the process is documented on Instagram if I can keep up with all of the demands on all of these various channels.
Platforms, I know.
Right. There's an ever increasing list. So it's just, for me, it's very, kind of therapeutic to be able to design and express that aspect of my interest and passion. And then there are also days where, you know, I'm not hearing back from the stores that I've reached out to, or the journalists or the editors that I've been hounding, or somebody reached out to me for a big deal and you don't hear back. And then what keeps me kind of centered in those instances are really just remembering why I started and who I started for. Because at the end of the day, I have more opportunity here. And I want to, and I'm very intentional about sharing the benefits of the opportunities that do come to me with others who don't have it. And that can look, that can take various forms. But you know, I can draw a very direct line now between how my business has gone over the past two years, and how my success has directly impacted the livelihoods of artisans who I work with in Uganda, for example, because they don't have any tourism right now. It's almost completely dried up as a result of the pandemic. And these are artisans who literally rely on tourism. So what do you do when your entire source of income dries up and there is no financial safety net like we had here in the US? So you know, that's really what keeps me going. Like, I'm not just doing this for myself. I'm doing it also for people and countries that I am committed to and love and really, really earnestly and profoundly care about. So that's what keeps me going when I'm just like so frustrated.
we all had those days as business owners. We're like, I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. I don't know why I'm doing this. Like, exactly, I could quit. Exactly. Maybe. I don't know.
Right.
There's got to be other jobs. And then you like recenter yourself. But you've got to go back to that why.
And then like the night, like 2 hours later, another email will come in. You're like, oh, never mind.
You're like, I'm fine. People are still watching. People are still interested. I've still got clients. I'm okay.
Exactly. Dial it it's back. So hot and cold. Oh my God, it's maddening, but I love it.
So we're going to switch gears and we're going to go to the interior design game. So it's love it or hate it, and then your why behind it. So okay. I picked some trend predictions from Apartment Therapy. These are all for this year, for 2022. And I wanted to get your thoughts on them, if you're feeling them or not. So the first one is warm minimalism. How do you feel about this idea?
I'm into it.
Okay.
Yeah,
I thought you would not be into it. So this is interesting. Why?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I think minimalism can be determined in different ways. And I know, you know, minimalism is such a buzzword right now. It's been for a while.
Yep.
I do consider myself a minimalist, and that's really at the core of my approach to design and lifestyle. Even down to the amount of space that I take up and the amount of space that I have in my home, and like, do I need a separate like room for my shoes and my belt? Like, that's aspirational and for a lot of people, but like, they'll have a 5,000, 10,000 square foot home and then be like, oh, but I'm a minimalist. But are you really, if you have like all of this space? How are you taking up space? And I think that's really where the conversation begins. And then in terms of warmth, I love modernism and minimalism, but like the brutalist concrete steel is too much for me. It's not soft. I need a little bit of, I need texture. Like, I'm a textile designer and sourcer, so I need that element of warmth in spaces as well. So I am into warm minimalism. Love it.
Surprised me.
That's funny.
Okay, the other one is cozy and comfy, but more of like, I feel like Apartment Therapy said like also it sparks joy, like that cocoon living. How do you feel about that?
Right. To me that sounds kind of hot. Like my ideal living, of course, like it's February and today this morning I woke up, the sun wasn't even up, it was 12 degrees outside. Yeah. I'm like, who is making up these temperatures and why? This is horrible. This is, why would anybody do this? So, you know, when that's the situation, of course I want to feel cozy. Like, I'm wearing my chunky sweater that I always wear and my wool house slippers. But in an ideal world, like, I'm in the tropics, I'm on the beach, I'm like in a warm place. And when I am spending time in Uganda in my home there, like, it's just all about having the, you know, the windows open and warmth from the sun and like coziness from in that sense. But if I'm seeing too many blankets or too many, you know, sheepskin rugs, which I do have, about four of them.
That's not too many.
Like, but when it's hot in my house, like, I need to put them away. I can't look at them.
I agree. I'm done.
I'm done.
Our hides come up.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it depends on the context, but in my ideal world, which is a tropical world, there would not be, and it wouldn't necessitate coziness.
Good day.
Right. Exactly.
So the next one's in with the old. So this is that idea of really buying vintage as much as possible.
I'm on the fence with that one. I think from a you know, sustainability standpoint, absolutely. And if you need something, quote unquote, new, absolutely look for maybe not even vintage, but used. I think vintage is a certain aesthetic and it's not for everybody. I don't have much vintage in my home, but I have a lot of used in my home. So whether it's like used from my parents or, you know, curb finds in Brooklyn, like I have some amazing Scandinavian pieces that I found in Brooklyn on the street because where else?
I miss those days.
Furniture.
You're really good stuff on the street in Brooklyn.
Really good stuff. I have some William Putner chairs. Same story. I found those on the street.
They were on the street
in San Diego. Even my Marcel Breuer chairs, similar story. Somebody gave me those and I reupholstered them, a set of four. So those are all vintage designs, but they were used.
Right.
So I think, you know, whatever your aesthetic is, but absolutely prioritize used furniture over brand new, because there's enough furniture in the world and the landfills are overflowing and we just in general need to create far less waste than we do. And there's enough furniture in the world. So
absolutely.
Let's focus on, reusing and reducing, and vintage if it, you know, is your aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Next one is curb the clutter.
Oh, man. I love it. I love it in theory. And as you said that, I looked over my left at a pile of clutter in my studio. See, what I did, I consolidated all the clutter in my house. It's all over there.
Like, so step one, just, all in
right.
a, yeah.
Exactly. So in my mind, I was like, yeah, if I put it all in one place, it'll drive me crazy enough, and then I'll tackle it. It hasn't worked out that way.
That sounds like
yet.
My basement. It's all like in the middle. And I'm right. like, I'll get to it. And then we just kind of find a way to pick around it. You're like, there's that
exactly.
one thing. I'm like, this is not
exactly.
the way.
This
we
is
we
not
really
the plan.
Adjusted.
So I 1000% love decluttering. In theory, it goes back to, you know, the minimalist principle for sure. And then I think even a step before that, I mean, honestly, a lot of the clutter that I have is just related to like mementos, like, you know, my son's school project that.
Oh, the school knows how to hit you with a lot
school.
Of that.
Exactly.
Ooh-wee.
Exactly. And I honestly, like, I feel a little bit bad saying this, but when he got a little bit older and there were no more projects coming home, like, it was kind of a relief because then I didn't feel obligated to like keep them, but I also love them, you know? So, I mean, there's old school assignments, it's ridiculous, but yeah, I think even before that, like, being more aware and thoughtful with what we're bringing into our home and what is coming to live with us and share space with us here. And Christine Platt, Afro-Minimalist, shout out.
Yes,
her.
I'm trying to get Christine on the show. I know
amazing.
You're listening, Christine.
Amazing. We'll make sure. Yeah, well, I'll actually send this to her once everything wraps up.
I have her book on the side as well, marked up.
I have it right here too. Yeah, I have it right next to me on my desk. She's also local. She's here. She's in DC, not too far from me. But, you know, she touches on the emotional ties that we have to our things. So, you know, we're not here in any way to wag, you know, she's not wagging her finger and I'm not wagging my finger at people who do hold on to objects that have a significance or a meaning, but she really peels back the layers as to why and how, kind of the psychology behind those attachments. And so, you know, declutter in a perfect world, absolutely, but while also respecting the emotional ties that we have and the emotional connections that some of these things convey for us.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Especially in black people.
And then the last one is inspiration is more local than ever. And just talking about really all the shipping delays, the troubles right. dealing with international products. This is a, you know, this right. is definitely part of your business. Do you feel like yeah. you're sourcing more local than ever?
I do not feel that way.
Okay.
I think local again has various interpretations. And mm-hmm. for me, honestly, in 2022, what I consider local is like any of the US, because my regular, like my lab is the world. And you know, the tagline for XM Studio is lifestyle without borders. Like, borders to me are totally fake. They're actually made up. Like, unless there's a wall. Like, we know some people love walls. Unless there's a wall that's stopping you from getting from one side to the other, and even in that case it's completely contrived and man-made, there are no borders. And so, you know, the world to me is local.
I cast
a wide net. I had a trip. I took a trip to Los Angeles in January, earlier last month, and it was to visit a close friend who's essentially a sister to me. She has been living in Singapore for the past couple of years, and she was gonna be passing through Los Angeles on her way back to Singapore from Hawaii. So I was like, pause, I'm coming to see you.
Yeah,
we're gonna catch
absolutely.
Up. I haven't seen you in so long. And so that was the express purpose of my trip. But I got to Los Angeles. It was my first time there in 14 years. And I was so inspired.
I love me some LA.
Oh my gosh. I was completely sprung. And I wasn't expecting it because I had been there before. And I also, like, I wasn't going for inspiration. I was going to see my friend and her family. But I just found it so inspiring. And it was really just like, you know, the succulents and the plants and being out in the sun. And of course it was February here, and like, you know, all of the attendant frustrations that come with the winter blues. So it was a nice respite in that sense. So, you know, LA is a 5-hour flight from DC, and you know, to me that's relatively local compared to Uganda, which takes an entire day to get to. So, and they were also just very similar vibes in LA. The weather was exactly like Kampala, exactly like. So even down to the weather, I felt like, you know, there were pieces that reminded me of lands much further away. And so local is also subjective.
The state of mind, everybody.
It's a state of mind. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, Nasosi, that is our interview. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, too. This was fun. We could talk all day.
I know. Absolutely. I'm like, I have fun. I'm gonna hit off the record.
Well, I hope you really enjoyed that conversation. I think there's plenty to take from that. Remember to check out the shoppable mood board at angelabelt.com. I have some great things from Nasosi's shop at XN Studio that you guys should check out. I did a really fun board this time, just being inspired by spring, being in Connecticut with winter. I'm so looking forward to spring right now. So I had fun kind of going through her shop and finding some great inspiration that you may want to bring home as well. I want to just thank everybody again for continuing to listen. There's been so much energy around the show. Spotify has recently highlighted it as Black Visionary Voices to listen to. Just super excited by all of the energy around this. Remember to continue to listen, subscribe, and share with your friends and family.